always throughout our lives and everything we do are focused on efficiency, even if it's just stuff around the house. But yet when you get out in the industry, especially in this construction industry, there's resistance to the same thing that they try out in their personal life to do all the time.
CEOs often feel stuck in the grind of scaling their business and feel like they're missing out on the best parts of life, like family, friends, or travel. On this podcast, CEOs come to take themselves and their companies to the next level. Let's dive into the Millionaire Mind with your host, Dallin Schultz.
Hey, welcome back to another Millionaire Mind episode where I have some of the most successful business owners sharing what motivates them to get out of bed every morning and how they elevate themselves and their companies to the next level. And in this episode, you're going to hear from a real estate professional that is on a mission to improve the development process by redefining construction methodologies with a focus on sustainability and longevity. I'm telling you, if you're in real estate, if you're in the construction space, you're gonna wanna pay attention to our guest today. So, special welcome to our guest, Dean Party. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Look forward to our discussion.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to it. Dean and I usually schedule like a quick 10 to 15 minute call with our guests before we schedule the interview. And Dean, I think you and I chatted for a good, gosh, probably 30, 45 minutes. We just had a really good conversation. So definitely looking to extend that and just invite our listeners into it as well. Mm-hmm. So to kick things off, Dean, why don't you just share with our listener a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Well, again, my name is Dean Pardee, and I am headquartered in Phoenix, Arizona. I originally started this company in California, but had to migrate out of the beautiful state of California because of the being a small business and doing business there. So it took me to new pastures. And I think I would say as an entrepreneur, being flexible is definitely a key to having. I mean, many people probably just would have said, heck, I'm not leaving my comfort zone in my area. So it was a challenge. It was a sacrifice. And it still sometimes feels that way. But what I do is we are a, I guess you'd say an industry disruptor. I think that becomes a little bit overused, but we really are changing the way construction is done from a methodology. There's two value propositions. We fabricate residential and commercial buildings in light gauge cold form steel framing. That means that's the silver stuff that replaces wood framing, not the structural steel. From a material standpoint, it should be, frankly, the only material we use in most applications of construction, in my opinion. But from a methodology standpoint, bringing in lean management, cutting edge technologies, and that's really what got me excited about this industry.
Excellent. Gosh, if you guys haven't heard of this process before, it's incredible. And it's something that, I don't know, Dean, do you feel like people are slow to adopt? Do you think we're on the initial adoption phase of this, if you will?
It's a great question. It's funny you asked me that this week. Yeah, it's strange because we've been using this methodology and these materials for centuries. The pilgrims, ironically, and their ships that came over, not the initial ships, but after, they actually did prefabrication of their structures. So when they got here, they quickly unloaded them and created shelters to expedite against the elements. The other thing is that a lot of people, I always ask industry professionals, how long did it take to build the Empire State Building? And they'll say, oh, 6 years, 4 years. It took 13 months to build that entire from foundation. And the reason why is they did prefabrication. Everything was exact. Everything was into a systematic, what was almost like a dance. It was so choreographed. They maximized efficiencies. But yet today, we're not only using deficient materials, but we're using inefficient processes. And that's what keeps me motivated in this and perplexed as to why I'm coming into an industry and people have been in it for 40 years, which is the challenge. If the only kickback I get is that this is what they've been doing for 40 years and why change now?
Such a old timer mindset, right?
Well, it makes you wonder, especially being an entrepreneur with that mindset, you just wonder about human nature. It gets you thinking about human beings and why we do have so many of the plights socially, politically, everything that are there. And humans, even though, especially Americans, as adventurous as we are, a lot of us just don't like change. And that resistance is something that, if you ask me a question later, I'll bring it up. But it's that getting out of the comfort zone and understanding, you know, a greater purpose.
And I think it's human nature to take the path of least resistance. Even if people know that it might be a better option or a better product, knowing that they're going to have to learn it, implement it, change it, maybe lose something else, change our mindset. We're funny beings and we choose a path of least resistance and we get comfortable. And if we're not hurting enough, it's hard to change.
Absolutely. Well, the thing is that the people that I deal with are the industry professionals that are representing clients that their clients put all their trust in, and they're doing a disservice to their clients because they are not exploring ways to build better, build faster, build more efficient. And even though, frankly, a lot of people don't care about it in the end of the day, building clean and more green. Unfortunately, that's something that there's a lot of hype on it, but no one in the end of the day, if it costs 5 cents more a square foot, we find that there's, again, this human resistance. Do I really want to spend that 5 cents? But they talk about it before the project. You talk a big game. And so it's interesting. Yeah.
And I definitely want to come back into this and talk more about it because it's fascinating. And I think a big part of it is education. People don't know what they don't know. So if they don't even know this is an option, it's hard to have a conversation about it. So we'll definitely come back to it. But one last point I want to touch on, and you probably will later, even if it is a little bit more expensive per square foot, the time to completion is significantly quicker. Am I correct?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the thing that I always tell people. I said, it's not the same analysis. It's not the same algorithm to quantify. Yes, steel will always be more expensive than wood, almost always. I mean, during COVID, actually, steel was way less than wood. But steel is less volatile. It is a better material. And to your point, you're shortening your construction times by 60-70% with a far better quality. So your carrying costs, your risk factors, your weather delays, your labor constraints are all mitigated as much as possible because you're taking the fabrication out of the field. And so we can install a 40-foot section that's already been fabricated in 20 to 30 minutes. That usually takes about 20 man hours, let's say people hours, to do. So you aggregate that. We can trade on a big project. We can take a year off the project. Well, if your carrying costs are $300,000 a month, do the math. But when you get some of the people that are put in position to make these decisions outside of the development company, they say, yeah, well, steel is more expensive. And that's where they leave it.
And just the time and the holding costs that you could save and minimal waste. I mean, you guys are cutting and creating these things to the exact measurements. If you needed a 6 foot out of a 8 foot 2x4, you're cutting off 24 inches and that's probably just going in the dumpster, right?
Oh,
and
that's
just wasted stuff that you're paying for that you're not actually utilizing. So that's something that's really fascinating about what you guys are doing.
You're absolutely right.
So, Dean, let's take it back. Mm-hmm. So, when would you say this entrepreneur journey for Dean really started?
Well, I've always been an entrepreneur, but I went to college because that's what you do. I was fortunate to go to good colleges, so it added opportunity. But I was one of those people that didn't really know what I wanted to major in, but knew that I wanted an education. And that still carried over when I got out of college. I said kind of, well, geez, what am I going to do for the rest of my life now that I'm a grown-up? And so I got into industries that I was not really interested in, but because they were the hottest industries at the time. And I went through I spent a lot of years just going through jobs that I didn't have that passion. And so when I went back to get my MBA at Wharton and got that education, like a lot of people, when they leave an MBA program, wherever they do it in the process, I realized I wanted to do something with a little bit more of my DNA in it. I was working in the entertainment media world. That was kind of transitioning over to Silicon Valley, and I didn't want to move to Silicon Valley, although it was exciting where I was in the ecosystem in Hollywood and where a lot of the value proposition that ironically that I have here in this industry carries over there. I just wanted to forge out on my own. So I came across this methodology and I got it right away and was surprised that people haven't adopted it as much as I immediately got it.
So tell us a little bit about being in the entertainment industry, because you went from entertainment to construction, development. So what were some of those things that you learned that you were able to gain that carried over?
Well, I was working for a post-production company where everything was driven by technology. We were transitioning analog material to digital. So if it was Gone with the Wind, if it was a new production, if it was done in analog, you couldn't do anything with it like you can today if it wasn't put into the digital world. But the studios were resistant to spend money on productions they had already created and had already been out to market. So it was very much trying to convince the industry that times have changed and there needed to be new technologies to get things moving to the next phase of the entertainment industry. And so everything was based on lean management technology. And so I brought that mindset into this industry, which is unfortunately, the most resistant to change and the most archaic of any industry. And people say that all the time. That's just not my opinion. It is, people just accept it. They go, yeah, that's the construction industry. But there are some great technologies, great materials out there that are underutilized because of the human resistance.
Why do you suppose that is?
Well, the lumber industry and the lumber lobbyists are a huge, huge problem. Because when they say, oh, well, lumber is recyclable or it's renewable, that's what they say. The funny thing is I'll take a piece of wood that I got from Lowe's and I'll take a piece of old growth wood and I'll take it into meetings with architects and structural engineers and developers. And I'll say, which one would you rather build with? The Lowe's wood, you can just break away with your nail. It's cheap lumber. If you look at the rings, it only has about 10 to 12 rings because that lumber didn't have a chance to grow to that old forest hardwood. And you check out the hardwood, not only is it lighter, but it's like stone. So the mandibles of termites, the fire resistance, the moisture penetration, those issues are a big issue. So that's been a real challenge.
And it's just because it's been this way for so long. And it's a massive industry, right? You can't go around any development, even large multifamily developments. It's all wood frame. It's all stick build.
Yeah. And then they'll complain about the wood, the moisture content in the lumber, the quality of the wood, the knots in the wood. If you've got framers that don't know how to frame wood in the proper grain direction, and what they do is they patch it all up. So when you have moisture content in lumber and that wood is framed and then it's eventually covered up and it dries out, it shrinks and causes a twisting and a shrinkage, which compromises the structure of the building. Every structural engineer knows that. Every GC will tell you horror stories about, well, we couldn't even get the lumber on time, or they came back and they upcharged us, or the quality was so bad we had to turn it away and get another order, and that caused delays. With steel, everything is 100% recyclable. It's the most recycled material of all materials used in construction combined. It's always consistent. And so none of these issues are there, but yet everyone, these multifamily developers, default to wood because that's what they know. And in reality, doing one project with them, which happens all the time, they're like, we're never going back to wood. I don't know why we didn't do this sooner. We take those, their headaches and their challenges away from them and give them a better product in the end of the day.
Even if they acknowledge and accept that there's issues, again, it's hard to get people to want to change, especially if they have all their entire crews and stuff built around wood framing. So yeah. In regards to that, like, let's say there's a builder listening to this right now, talk to them, share with them what reason, like they might be sitting there and say, yeah, I hear you, Dean. I agree with you, but my entire crew and business, like they all know how to do stick build. If we were to go this route, I don't have a crew for that.
Yeah. It's like, you've been listening to my phone calls. Yeah. You're spot on. I mean, that's what they say. And so what I say is, look, everything that we do is in the international code book. So everything, we follow the strict guidelines of the structural engineer. We cut all the steel components so it's within a half a millimeter of the intended size. So therefore, you're getting a building. It's been described, building this way is like building with Legos. You can't cheat. Every corner is 90 degrees. We go into custom homes and we do custom homes and they have a 40-foot roof line, unobstructed, and it's perfectly straight, and it will be perfectly straight for 100 years. With wood, that's just not going to happen. So they acknowledge all these things, and this is where we continuously have an educational dynamic and try to talk about the issues on their projects, either in this particular project that we're talking about or in the past. And they'll, again, we go through and we mitigate those labor issues, the labor poaching, the weather delays, the supply constraints, the theft and vandalism of materials on a job site. Often, like in San Francisco and Oakland, there was a time where a lot of those buildings were wood framed and they'd get up to about three stories of, let's say, a 6 to 8 story building, and the transients would come and set them on fire or steal the materials. We keep everything off site and we deliver the materials systematically when they're needed. So again, that mitigates those risks that would otherwise cause delays and higher costs.
I wonder if this has something to do with it as well, the resistance to change. And maybe you have some insight here more than I do. I've heard that the average age of project managers in construction is like early to mid 50s. Like there's not younger people coming into the space. Do you see this being adopted quicker as that pendulum starts to swing back and younger generations with their tech minds and stuff start flooding into the industry?
Yeah, great question. It's two things. To your point, yes, I'm seeing the project managers, the architects, the decision makers who are in their 50s, 60s, the ones that are the impediments right now from that standpoint because of their age. And again, as we've talked about, doing what they're familiar with. The flip side of that is I do see the younger people come in, and especially it's encouraging to see women more and more penetrating the market because they tend to be more open-minded, I find. Maybe it's a male-female thing, but I mean that as a complete compliment to the women out there, that it's encouraging. I have greater discussions with them because they're more curious. They want to learn, and for whatever reason. But I am working with a lot of younger guys also that it is encouraging. And I'm working with one particular guy who worked at a company that was very resistant to big multifamily developer, completely resistant to wood framing, but he moved over to a company and he got it right away. So he's been a complete evangelist, and we're actually pricing out some projects, and it's very encouraging. So the one challenge also that I might say is the younger people, problem is they're not the decision makers right now. They get it. Yeah. They understand it. They're promoting it. They're giving them the numbers. They're doing the quantitative analysis. And then they hand it to their boss, who's at that latter part of the age, who makes the decision and then defaults back to their comfort zone.
And with any adoption of anything, right, I believe that there has to be a certain level of social proof. And since there are so many people doing the stick build that are resistant to change, I could see that causing a delay in trying to get more people adopting the method. Because at some point, word's going to start spreading. The developers are going to be talking. They're going to be communicating. And then this is all we're going to know. And this is going to become the new norm. Now, with what you've seen, do you have any thoughts, ideas, projections of when this style of building you would anticipate becoming the new norm?
Well, I'm seeing more and more on LinkedIn and other things online about prefabrication really becoming a centerpiece. Unfortunately, when people think of prefabrication, they think of modular. Modular has been a real setback in evolution because modular is limited in many ways. It generally tends to be box-type buildings. When they do create these structures, let's just call them boxes, for lack of a better phrase, and then they ship them out, the shipping costs are high because they're shipping air. So modular also, and when they're shipped, they get damaged a lot. So right now there's a big, and humans always overcompensate. So for a while, really, I think because of the shipping container fad that quickly and thankfully went out, modular became the thing to do. But then they realized that they're, again, frames were being bent. If it was done in wood, wood was cracking as they were lifted. The thing that is starting to finally shift to is where we are with panelization. When you're taking a custom built, let's just call it a 6,000 square foot home, and you're panelizing it, you can actually stack them up like you would pool cues. Everything's lined up. It's easier to ship them, and you're shipping all material. You're not shipping air. So yeah, the industry is evolving. Yes.
And we already see this in Phoenix area, especially. The industrial warehouses are going through the roof. Like, you can't look at any undeveloped land without seeing a new warehouse going up. And what do they call it? Is that tilt?
Tilt up. Pre-engineered metal buildings, tilt up.
So you see this basically big slabs of concrete that they prefabricated, that they bring to site, and then they tilt them up.
Yeah.
And so I think this idea of prefab, to your point, a lot of people, when they hear prefab, they think manufactured home, they think modular, they think cheap, they think, right? And that's not what this is. You're referring to it as prefab because, yes, you are fabricating it before you deliver it to site.
Yes. So, and what we call it is, and what I put in my literature, is factory fabrication. And that came up from one of my former employees and still a good friend. And that was, couldn't have been a better word. It's factory fabricated. You're right. Prefab does have a connotation of cheapness. That's unfortunate, but when people get educated on it, that quickly gets dispelled. But you're right, that is initially the Kia type of perception.
And there, Dean, if you find that marketing term or phrase to completely shift people's vision of this prefab, like, boom, that's it. That's all it's going to take.
And also the other thing too I want to mention is concurrent construction. That is a huge component. That's this, we are fabricating 300,000 square foot buildings in a factory. Well, they're doing all the groundwork, all the infrastructure work, all the concrete work. So when they have 6 months or 8 months of groundwork, we're already fabricating the building. So I've never really found the right analogy, but it's kind of like you're driving home from work and you've got someone already cooking your dinner and taking out the garbage and doing all that stuff. And so when you come home, you're like, oh, I have more time on my hands now. So it's just efficiencies. And we always throughout our lives and everything we do are focused on efficiencies, even if it's just stuff around the house. But yet when you get out in the industry, especially in this construction industry, there's resistance to the same thing that they try out in their personal life to do all the time. So that is a challenge. Yeah, getting the vernacular accurate is, yeah, definitely a challenge.
Do you see any pushback from the lending agencies, banks wanting to loan on this type of stuff? Because it's different, because they're slow to change with some things as well.
Yeah, you asked the best questions. It's funny. I was up in San Francisco and having that discussions with a GC up there talking about, as I mentioned before, how buildings were being vandalized or set on fire or material stolen on the job sites in downtown San Francisco. And I had a meeting with this SVP of a major bank in San Francisco, who at that time was doing most of the lending for commercial projects. And we're talking skyscrapers in downtown San Francisco and throughout the Bay Area. And we went through the whole value proposition, and he had his whole committee in there. And he said to me, he said, Dean, he goes, I get it. He goes, I think this is the way we should build. The problem is, I couldn't believe he said this. He goes, we're worried that if we need the walls on September 1st, what if you don't deliver them? I mean, what if you just don't show up? Which is ridiculous as possible, because for one, they can take the walls, the framing at any time. They can inspect them throughout the process. Because again, we're starting months before they're needed in the field. They can have a person there at the factory. We're completely transparent. And secondly, when you do talk to a lot of these GCs, they're like, yeah, just here in Phoenix, concrete isn't delivered to projects, residential or multifamily projects, because the concrete guys will get a higher offer that morning and take it up to the Taiwanese chip manufacturing. So suddenly they have guys sitting there in the field all day, not having anything to do because the concrete wasn't delivered. So materials.
Their concern is stuff that already happens in construction.
That's my point. Exactly.
Supplies don't get show up. There's a backlog. You got supply chain issues. So,
and then I say to them, I say, look, if you want to take the walls or the framing a month in advance, we can bring them out to site and you can have them there. Well, we don't want to get them stolen or vandalized. So I'm like, well, wait a minute. You're doing that with the lumber. It's a double standard. And it's kind of one of those things you have to prove yourself correct exponentially more just to get them to do it for the first time. And then they go, ah, I get it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Hey, Dallin Schultz here with Rev Equity Group. We just launched an exciting new investment opportunity for those looking to diversify their investments across 1,000+ apartment units in some of the hottest markets in the country. If you are fed up with banks and the stock market and want to invest in hard assets to more effectively grow and preserve your wealth, then click on the link in the show notes for more info, or go to investwithrev.com and schedule a short 15-minute intro call so we can determine if our investment strategy is aligned with your goals. It's time to take your financial future into your own hands. Take action, schedule a call, and find out how my team can serve you. At Rev, we make apartment investing easy. Dean, what's been one of the biggest learning curves or challenges you've had coming into this industry and really trying to push this new way of development?
Well, we talked about it. It's the only pushback I ever get is the archaic thinking. There are no facts. There are no technical data points. There's nothing that they ever come back with a reason why what we do in using steel is not better. It's just, as I heard this week, this is what I've been doing for 40 years, so why change now?
So how do we overcome that?
Well, hopefully aging out those types of people and with that mentality. And I'm not trying to throw anyone under the bus. It's just they inherently have that mindset. It's getting a greater awareness of better ways to build that are away from the lumber lobbyists. That's unfortunate that there's so much misperception. And when you talk about clear cutting forests and things like that, everyone acknowledges it in the poor quality of wood. They all acknowledge it, but yet everyone still has this thing that wood is a better material. Part of it's time. Part of it is doing projects, educating those people in that ecosystem for that project, and then marketing the bejesus out of them. Timeline. Like we have that with projects now. We do timeline. We did a 9-story building in 11 months, and that usually takes about 2 to 3 years, about 2.5 Jeez. To 3 years to do. And you get a better structure at the end of the day. So it's just doing it and then memorializing and creating these educational tools so people can see it. Even though, again, we're not doing anything that hasn't been done for at least a century.
And it's interesting because one of the questions I was going to ask, and maybe you don't have an answer to this, but like, when did stick construction, when did that become the norm? And what did we do before that?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, using wood has obviously been around forever, but even in Europe, they went to more of a concrete type of structure and in using concrete block or stone. In Europe, they still, they predominantly use concrete. And we were actually talking to the Ukrainian government about reconstruction there because the reality is they're never going to rebuild their country in concrete. For one, it's going to take way too long. There's not enough concrete. It's a slow, laborious, expensive material. Yes, it's resilient to bombs, but you don't really build cities to protect against bombs in most cases. So we're seeing a huge shift in European mentality and awareness, and they're going to steel, which is really surprising. And I would like to say I was part of that conversation because I was talking to the World Bank, the EBRD, others about that. And so Europeans look at Americans and say, why do you guys build the way you do?
I'm sure that's not the only thing they look at and say,
yeah,
like,
right. What? Well, I mean, even with plumbing, PEX plumbing. And it's interesting now, as I mentioned earlier, they just really discovered and analyzed the material that goes into the Roman concrete and why it took us 1,000 years or at least several centuries to find the formula that Romans built their concrete, which is far better than concrete we use today. Just why did people let it go? What were people doing all that time? But yeah, people have been building with wood for a long time, and certainly metal and steel was not a building material up until really about the 1850s, and then it really kicked in about the 1920s and 30s, predominantly because of the growth of New York City.
Would you say that because of technology and stuff, the big leaps and bounds we've experienced over the last 5, 10, 15 years, is that making this option more doable than maybe it would have been 20 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the BIM software, that's B-I-M, BIM software, the other 3D software for design and engineering, and is all leaps and bounds above what people used to do with the pen and paper. And God bless them. I mean, to do that stuff with pen and paper, I mean, they were true geniuses and they were craftsmen. But one thing that I find very surprising in this industry is the best materials are the materials not being used for the most part when it comes to insulation, other things. And the reason being is that, talk about lobbyists, the fiberglass industry is as bad as the lumber industry in their lobbying. And so bat insulation is a horrible material to use. It's not rigid. It breaks down. When they stick it in walls and they compact it and they break the fibers, it loses its thermal performance, or what we call R factor. Hemp, mineral fiber, other composite materials like foams are much better. But even ironically, in parts of California, the cities are mandating that we put EPS, like a 2-inch layer of EPS on the exterior of the buildings. Well, if you go into an NTA fire testing lab and you do testing on expanded polystyrene or that white rigid foam that you see in the TV boxes and you get your appliance boxes, and it melts at 100 degrees and it becomes a fuel accelerant. So our building departments, which are a big problem in this evolution of construction, by the way, but they're mandating in many cities that you put basically a fire accelerant around your building. Go figure. It's trying to compensate for things, and it's frustrating.
So what are some things that you and your company have in the works to really move this forward and push it? Like, what are some of your short term, I'd say 12 to 18 month goals to get this to that next level?
Yeah, I'm meeting with several, as I have been since COVID. I mean, we really got hit hard by COVID because projects that weren't being produced, if you will, or constructed at that time really got put on hold. Then we had the labor constraint. Then we had the supply constraints, you know, all the ships we saw off the ports. Now we have interest rate issues. So I have projects that I priced out 2 years ago that suddenly are coming back online. So remind me your question again. I'm sorry. I get
what you and your company are doing to push this forward to get to the next level.
Sorry about that. So what we're doing is really going out and garnering and securing those projects in the residential commercial space. I'm actually meeting with some luxury home developers, which is really the reason why I got into this industry, was to do luxury homes. Because if you're building a house for $2,000 a square foot, who cares if wood is an extra $2 a square foot? Who cares? You have a home that has a lifespan of at least 150 years, but yet wood have all those issues. So it's just really getting projects in the residential and commercial space and then memorializing those. And that's the thing that I'm spending all my time with right now. We've got the fabrication process down. We fabricate, we've got it running. It's funny because a lot of people have come in this industry and left. And a lot of companies went under. Katira went through, burned through a couple $1 billion. And others have had that same prescient, had issues because they had a proprietary system. Well, I've made it a point to learn from these companies that made their mistakes. They had certain reasons, but it was never because of prefabrication or in some cases using cold form steel. That was never the issue. It was archaic management styles and bad strategies. So just getting out there and memorializing these successes are where we're going to get the industry to change.
And really being able to showcase a completed project, show people the, get all that data and really, and you probably already do, but when people can actually physically see and touch something, it becomes easier for them to accept it. So
it is funny on that note, if I can just jump in, because people say, well, do you have a demo home or do you have a multifamily could show us? I'm like, yeah, we'll take you to one. And then they come and see it and they're like, it's just a building. Like, well, what did you expect? It's a building that everything's behind the walls. But what they acknowledge, but they can't see, is that that is a much more fire resistant, a building that is going to have much, much fewer maintenance costs during the lifespan. It's going to have lower insurance premiums. You're going to have doors and windows that shut. Every corner is 90 degrees. So things come in, they fit perfectly, and you have a lighter building. So in some parts, like in Miami or in Florida, when you have maybe sand or weaker soil, you have a lighter building that has a greater structural integrity. And we're rated to a Category 5 hurricane. So you're getting a lighter building and stronger. It's the same thing that we do in the aeronautics industry.
It seems like a no-brainer, right? Like just listening to it, you're like, okay, so...
Welcome to my hell. If you ask me what keeps me up at night, I'm just like, why don't people get it? And I mean, I'm no smarter than anyone else. I mean, everything I'm saying has masses of amounts of documentation behind it.
Sure.
So this is not my...
It's not theory.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, listen, I'm on board with it. I'm sold. You don't have to sell me. And I think a lot of people listening to this would get it as well, because we're business owners, we're entrepreneurs. We're always looking for those systems that are broken or old that can be improved upon. So really excited to see, Dean, where you take this, especially over the next couple of years. And there's actually a couple of introductions I'd love to make for you. So we'll do that offline. That's after right. This interview. So awesome. Well, as we wrap this up, Dean, and again, thank you so much for your time. I knew this was going to go by quick. We're already at the end of our interview. But as we wrap this up, there's four questions I like to ask every guest at the end of every show. And the first one being is, what is one absolute book recommendation for those looking to scale and further develop their millionaire mind?
Well, I would say, and I don't really know the title of it, but any book written about George Patton, the general, the American general in World War II. People focus so much on processes and things like that. In reality, it comes down to the human element at the end of the day. And someone like Patton, who, yes, he had his abrasiveness, but he was, when someone told him he couldn't do something, he did it. When they said, oh, it's going to have to be done this way, he found a better way to do it against massive challenges and against odds. And so I love anything that Patton any of his quotes. Churchill is another one. Sometimes it's more about the mindset of those people that you can learn from rather than how they build a building or how they did whatever they do.
I agree 100%. And what has been one of your favorite quotes that you've embodied and lived by?
All right, here you go. Great spirits have always encountered violent opposition by mediocre minds. Einstein.
And when you're an entrepreneur, say that one more time.
Great spirits have always encountered violent opposition from mediocre minds. So
it's powerful.
It hits the entrepreneur note. I'm not one that can remember jokes and phrases, but that one just has always stuck with me. I even will probably put it on my gravestone because it's what we're all about as an entrepreneur, is overcoming those mediocre minds to do something better and really provide a solution.
100%. Well, Dean, if there was one thing you could share with fellow business owners that are beginning or simply trying to get to that next level, what would it be?
I'm going to throw you a curveball here. It's important, and I don't really know how to phrase it so it doesn't turn people off, but the process is more of a spiritual process than it is an economical business standpoint. And you'll get people who, like I did for years, work my ass off to try to get success, hitting these strong headwinds and wondering why. And when you realize that there are certain things in us from conditioning from childhood and stuff that oftentimes create these subconscious belief systems that we have to overcome, and that no matter how hard we try, whether we have the cure for cancer, whether we have the spaceship that will get us out there in the universe, if we don't believe it and we don't live it and we don't own it, the universe isn't going to provide it for us. So I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about spirituality. And I think that's where a lot of entrepreneurs, especially when you're getting, you're worried about money and you're worried about everything, and there's always someone telling you you can't do it or why are you doing it? And you always know that there's a more secure way of going back. I can just go work for Bank of America and just make X amount of money a year and do the same thing. There's more security in that. But it's the spiritual journey that I think entrepreneurs, if they really looked into it, and there's some great stuff on YouTube that really starts getting the mind reprogrammed. And nothing hokey. I'm not a how-to type of book guy or anything like that. But there's just some things that when you start doing it for a while, it will start resonating with your subconscious and go, and you're going to start seeing changes. I sometimes just even doing things like sage my house or my office, I'll suddenly, the phone will start ringing off the hook for the rest of the week. I'm like, so what causes that? I don't know. And I'm not trying to claim I do, but I do know that clearing those pathways can create success.
I love what you said. The process is more of a spiritual process. And I agree 100%. And I think it's the lack of spirituality in a lot of people's lives. And again, not necessarily religion, right? Spirituality. Right. I'd say the lack of spirituality in people's lives, it's what's really preventing them from getting to that next level.
We're also in the quantitative mindset all the time. We're always analyzing. Yeah. We're always in the business mode. And we forget that we're human beings, that we're forgetting about our emotions, all those, our feelings. And again, our belief systems from childhood. I mean, there are people that had horrific childhoods that find success, but then they're miserable. There are people that had the opposite. It's everyone has their own journey, and there's no simple answer. But whatever someone's spiritual path is, and whatever they do to find it, I strongly recommend before you go spend tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars on an idea, look into that first.
Yeah, well said. Awesome. Well, Dean, how can our listeners learn more about you and your business?
Well, I always love getting great connections on LinkedIn. Again, my name is Dean Pardee, P-A-R-D-E-E. My company is Fortress Innovations. Our website doesn't really do us justice because we're really trying to fly under the radar, but you can always reach out to me on LinkedIn. Would be a great way to start. I haven't really done a lot of social media. Just wanted to, again, stay under the radar for the industry and stay focused. But we intend to, as we have some of these projects go into 24, we're going to start amplifying our social media presence.
Awesome. Look, this has been an incredible conversation with Dean. And if this is your first time listening, I'm so glad that you tuned in. People have been asking me what my company does. So since I have you here listening to my show, I'll share that with you now. My company partners with busy professionals just like Dean that are looking to experience significant tax savings, have more to invest, and even reinvest their hard-earned capital. And we work with other successful business owners like you by offering them opportunities to invest alongside us in large apartment deals. If you've been frustrated with the stock market, want to grow capital in something you can actually touch and see, and invest in one of the most recession-resilient asset classes, then you can find out how I could serve you by visiting investwithrev.com. It can be overwhelming vetting the right investment and the right operator, but at Rev, we make real estate investing easy. Dean, again, thank you so much for coming on and just sharing this incredible technology that it's not if, it's when it becomes the norm.
Absolutely.
And I think you can agree 100% with that as well.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. It's nice to hopefully reach yours out there, and I'm happy to answer any questions or help anyone out any way I can. So, and thank you, and look forward to staying in touch with you.
Awesome. And to our listener, remember, you can't have a $1 million dream with a minimum wage work ethic. So go out there and earn your win for today, and we'll catch you on the next episode.
Hope you got value from this episode of The Millionaire Mind, a journey into the mindset of successful business owners. If you want to get results, you've got to take the right steps to get there. Dallin hosts a free weekly educational webinar focused on teaching you how to start investing in apartments so you too can experience the benefits of real estate ownership without doing any of the heavy lifting. There you can gain insights, connect with others like you, and ask Dallin all your burning questions about how you can start owning apartments today. Go to themillionairemind.us. That link is in the show notes.